bunch of seniors and juniors, a couple sophomores. This is going to be fun. Let me first of all tell you this. Those of you that haven't had a class with me before, especially this one, where I'm so thankful. Don't take this the wrong way. But we had 26 enrolled in here, and I was like, oh man, that's going to be difficult to do a class like this, 26 students. Some have dropped, and I'm ecstatic. Because this, so don't take that the wrong way. This small of a class, though, is going to be awesome. Because the way I teach is I love to teach more dialogue-based, especially on a book like Revelation, which there's so many different, so much baggage that we have to pull away, and so much different things that you're going to have opinions on or perspectives on that I want you to be able to dialogue with me about, so that we can, in a good community, figure out how this book can function in the life of the church. So I'm very thankful, but I'm telling you right now, I expect dialogue. I expect questions if I'm not being clear on something. I expect comments if you've heard something different. I am delightful if you challenge me on things. Just that's the way that these classes are going to go. Okay? So that's just kind of a understanding. I'm supposed to do book stuff. I know one of the books isn't there yet. It should be there. The Dragons, John, and Every Grain of Sand should be there in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Supposedly. So when it is here, I will make sure that I let you guys know, and you can pick that up from the bookstore when it is available. Does anybody not have the Stephen Smalley commentary? 1, 2, 3. Raise it high and proud. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is for the bookstore, so if they need to, you know, re-get some more, that's what it's for. If you buy them not from the bookstore, that's fine. That's up to you. But I'm just telling you what the bookstore needs to know. Okay. Everybody needs Dragons John. And then Revelations Rhapsody, Dr. Lowry. Anybody not have that one? 1. Okay. All right, whenever, I will let the bookstore know this, and whenever those come in, they'll let me know. But if you have other avenues in which you're getting your books anyway, then it doesn't matter. But I'm doing what I'm told. So, two things down. I have a couple more. Everybody have a syllabus? You do not have a syllabus? Raise your hand. 1. Okay, they are in the bookstore. I wanted to provide that for you in the bookstore. But if you do not, I probably should just do this real quick. Let me just show you. Yes, you can get it online too. Oh, good grief. This is so annoying. Okay, you can't tell what I'm writing, right?
Oh!
Jesus
estimation. All right. You go to shanejwood.com as I pierce at you glazingly. And you go to classes at the top. Click on classes. And then you go down here in this awesome picture by Greco. You click on Exegesis of Revelation. There's a syllabus. Okay? So you have it in two forms. The reason why I put it in the, actually had it printed off for you to get, so that you get it early enough to where you can start wrestling through some of the issues as well. But it's also online in case you lose the one that you have. Okay? All right. The syllabus. I want to just talk to you about the structure of the class. Because most exegesis classes aren't taught the way this one is going to be taught. We're going to go through the book of Revelation 3 times this semester. We are recapitulating. you'll learn that word later. and here's the reason why. I am not going to assume that you know anything about the book. Matter of fact, today we are going to start off about as ground level as you can, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But we're going to start off in the introductory sections. Whenever you're going through reading Dr. Lowry's book, the introductory sections, we're going to be painting in very broad strokes. We're going to be talking about basic principles of interpretation and how those impact Revelation. And in these lectures, some of which you will have 4 in class and 4 that you will watch online, because we're losing 4 class periods, I've put a video assignment in that you'll get to catch up on all 4 of those lectures. So there's always ways around it. But those first ones, we are painting in broad strokes, but we will try to hit every chapter of Revelation in the broad strokes. Then what we're going to do is in 11 to 14, because I've put some leeway in there in case we get good discussion one day. 11 to 14 class periods, we are going to take our strokes, and they're still going to be broad, but they're going to be a little less broad, and I'm going to go through all 21 chapters of Revelation in about 14 lectures. So you'll feel like, whoa, this is really fast. It's okay. We're painting in broad strokes on purpose because I'm wanting to start off very surface, come down a little bit more to the surface, and then the last half of the class, you are going to be writing a 16 to 18 page paper, and you're thinking, why so big? This is a 500 level class. That's why. 16 to 18 page paper, but no need to worry, no need to fret, because we'll talk about the way in which the class is structured assignment-wise, and you'll be fine. But the last half of the class, we are going to be reading two papers a class. You will read the two papers from your classmates before you come to class, and then people we will dialogue and critique the papers in class. I'm using the word critique not in a negative connotation, not in a negative way. Matter of fact, one of the things I will grade the person that is critiquing your paper on is how encouraging they are. You hear that? This is not a time to beat somebody over because they missed something. Matter of fact, I don't handle that very well. If somebody is being rude to someone else, that's one of the things. Matter of fact, ask my kids what they get disciplined the most about, and it's the way they treat other people. I don't mess around with people being presumptuous as if you know everything about this chapter and this person missed something, okay? So it's still going to be done with grace, but in that class period, we are going to be talking about each chapter, every single chapter in Revelation again. The only chapter that will not be done, will not be written on, is chapter 20. And the reason why I'm not letting anybody write on that is because, well, I'll tell you why. I did my master's thesis on it, and I'm doing my PhD on it, and you don't want to be writing something for somebody that's doing that much work on it. That's just not fair. You know, you see what I mean by that? It's not fair. So, yeah, and so I didn't want to do that to anybody, because, especially because I have a highly nuanced understanding of Revelation 20, and we'll get to that later. So, no one's writing on Revelation 20. It's not fair. The other 22 chapters will be written on, though. They will be written on. And as you can see, we'll start off broad. I'll go over the whole text. And then when we're going over each of the papers in class, we're going to be more in depth. By that time, you will have been through the book for your third time. You will have done your own reading of the commentaries. You'll have done your own study on the passage. And you'll be able to dialogue on a different level about the texts. So we're building up to the really deep stuff. Do you see how this is working? So don't freak out if you've really never messed with Revelation before. It's okay. Relax. We're gonna walk through this very steadily. If you look at your syllabus, you may not have it with you, but that's okay. I have purposefully, intentionally, front-loaded the class. A lot of your assignments, you will be done with pretty much all of your assignments by the end of March. The only thing you'll have to turn in is your paper, and that is 2 weeks after you get back from week of E. I was not going to make you do it the week after week of E because that's just brutal. So 2 weeks after week of E, you will have that in. And then what your assignments will be at the end of that is simply to read the papers we're reviewing in class, and then you'll have to critique somebody else's paper. But most of your assignments are up front. I mean, it is front loaded. So very next class period, you'll have a memory work, Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. The way I do memory works is you come in with a blank sheet of paper, you write it out word for word, every word is worth a point, you grade it yourself, you turn it in. Okay? So as soon as you walk in next class period, I don't even need to say go, you just sit down, do the memory work, boom. Next class period also, you need to know, we need to have established what paper passage you are doing. There is a list of the paper passages, it's somewhere in the syllabus. And actually, I'm going to make this statement because we've lost some students. You can only do a text, not a topic. I had listed topics because we had 26 students, but now that we're down to 20, I'm saying you can't do topics. You have to do texts because I want to cover the whole book again. Okay? Is this clear as mud? Everybody follow me? So next class. And it is a first-come, first-served basis. I've already had three people already tell me what passages they want. Okay? So, first come, first serve. Whatever's left whenever you get there, if you come last, you're just going to get what's left. Okay? Every passage, though, is fantastically wonderful and full of all kinds of craziness. So, it's not like you'll be missing out, no matter what passage you get. I don't want to explain the video assignment. Read about it. If you have any questions about it, let me know. They're all online on shanejwood.com. and you can watch them all. They are videos. You watch them all on there. I'm going to want your notes. And you, in 2 weeks, we have a whole week off. That's why you're doing the video assignments during that week. International Focus Week is the third week of class, and we lose every 10 o'clock class period that week because Joni Erickson Tata is doing a special chapel on Friday. So, yeah. Oh, let me do this really quick, too. You will see on here as you keep going, I have purposely did the assignments, though, to help you succeed in your paper. Okay? So, for example, where is it at? Inductive study that's due February 25th. You have to do the inductive study on one of the themes I put in the syllabus, but the one that you find in the passage that you choose for your paper. You have to. So if you choose chapter 7, you probably are going to need to do your inductive study over numbers because the 144,000, 12,000, the four, you're going to need to do it over numbers. So whatever passage you choose, that will help. You will have to be able to tell me the inductive study and how it connects to your passage that you're doing your overall paper for. The second major assignment up front is called the Old Testament Allusions Assignment, where in the back of Dr. Lowry's book, there is an appendix of all the Old Testament allusions and their parallels to the verses in Revelation. You will take your text that you're doing your paper from, and you will have to look up every Old Testament allusion that's listed in his book and then interact with it. So what I'm having you do is doing basic research that you're going to do outside of the readings that you'll do from commentaries and things like that. You'll be doing your research in the earlier assignments. So it should prep you and prepare you for your paper. If you also notice, on March 11th, you will have to meet with me that week and give me your thesis and your outline for the paper. We will have a 20-minute meeting, and we will talk about the positives and negatives of your thesis and your outline. All of that means this. Start your research on your passage this weekend. You think I'm kidding. For your paper, this is not a paper that you want to wait to the week or two before to do. Not smart. Do not do that. You will be a wreck. I have had people, because they waited on big papers till the last minute, end up dropping the class 3 to 4 months in because they just procrastinated on the paper. If you're a procrastinator, you need to stop. Number one, for ministry purposes, but number two, for this class, this class will eat you alive if you're a procrastinator. If you're not, you'll be fine. It really, honestly, this class isn't, I don't know the rumors that you've heard. This class is not intended to kill you. Everything I've done, I've tried to make it to where it's going to help you succeed in the class. But if you wait till the last minute on all your assignments, you're going to be a mess. But that's for every class that you're in here. So, any questions so far about all this? Yes, after this class period, yeah, because I'm not going to take them now, but after this class period, yeah, it's free for all. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, first come, first serve. I actually have a list right up here of all of them, and so I can even pin them in right now, after class right now. Okay, strategy of the books. I do want to give you a reason why I'm having each of the books. It's not just because I want you to buy $100 worth of Revelation books. This book, Revelation's Rhapsody, Dr. Robert Lowry, he was my mentor up in Lincoln. He did his PhD work at Aberdeen under I. Howard Marshall on the book of Revelation. This book is intentionally written for the level of people sitting in the pews. That's how it is written. You will notice a lot of my early lectures are going to be overlapping a lot of what you're reading. And the reason why is because I was his research assistant while he was writing this book, and so this is kind of a lot of the stuff that he was doing, I was doing at the same time with him. The Old Testament allusions appendix, that was my job. So you will notice, be like, hey, that kind of sounds, these are kind of paralleling. That's good. That's supposed to. The idea is that there's a Jewish proverb that repetition is the mother of all wisdom and knowledge. What I want you to do, especially up front, is I want to heavily overload you on repetition of basic principles, because that will set a good foundation so that we can build upon throughout the rest of the semester. So this book is the ground level. You need to read this one first. This one will get you acclimated to kind of the environment of Revelation, as will the first eight lectures. The second book, Stephen Smalley. I wanted to make sure that you guys had a medium level commentary. This is not your super technical Beale commentary. He does a pretty good job. There's some things that I don't like that he does, but that's pretty much the way it is with every commentary. He's a Catholic scholar that he's written a PhD at Cambridge. Anyway, good book. Really solid. It'll be something that whenever you're in your ministries, you'll be able to pull back out again and look at some good references as far as that's concerned. Because I didn't want to give you low-level commentary like Metzger's Breaking the Code, because you need something solid on your shelf. And we can talk about other commentaries and levels of them and who you should tell to go where. Anyway, the last one is Dragons, John, and Every Grain of Sand. I don't have that. It's the book that I've been editing for in honor of Dr. Lowry for the past year and a half. It is intentionally more advanced. The ones you will be reading there are much more technical issues and general studies issues on the book of Revelation. We can talk about more about the structure of it later. There is the whole last seven chapters is on applying the book of Revelation, where Matt Proctor wrote in there about how to teach Revelation to the church, J.K. Jones on preaching. The first section's on general studies in Revelation. So you have, you get some really technical ones, like Craig Evans is on the Jewish polemics in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. And it's pretty technical. But then you are, and well, yeah, well, you'll look at that later. So the middle section, though, is on difficult texts in Revelation. Where Mark Scott wrote on Revelation chapter 12, Jeff Snell wrote on Revelation 11, I. Howard Marshall wrote on Revelation 20. You get the idea. So it's split up into three sections intentionally to take you a deeper level. So the books are progressively more difficult, just like the class. Broad strokes, a little bit deeper. That one's going to take you to a new level. Make sense? Cool. All right, any questions before we dive right in? This class does go to 11:15. So we get a bonus 25 minutes just to make sure y'all are on the same page. That's what I'm talking about. We're going to need every bit of it. I'll tell you that much right now. The first 3 weeks, and I say 3 weeks because also considering the videos, we are going to be dealing ground level. Principles of interpretation type stuff. And you may be thinking, why is juniors and seniors, do we need to be going over stuff like today? We're talking about context today. And I'm going to be using examples that you've heard 1,000 times. You're going to be thinking this is so remedial. Yeah, and here's the reason why I'm doing that. When you come to the book of Revelation, a lot of times for some reason we think we got to chuck out all of these basic principles and do something fancy and new. It's kind of like whenever you play basketball and you've been playing basketball for 20 years. And you're just really not doing well anymore. You're kind of in a slump. And what do they always tell you to do? Go back to the basics, the fundamentals. You need to go back over the fundamentals to get you back into the mode to where then you can build on those fundamentals and do things more fancy. When it comes to Revelation, you cannot start off doing things fancy and crazy. We can't just dive right in and start talking about all these whatever. What is the dragons that are, that it's floating around? And what is the beast that are coming? It's not wise to do that. Or even asking questions that, frankly, you're not prepared to ask. Like, what is 666? Will we talk about that? Yeah, we'll talk about that. But not at the beginning. The next three weeks, four class periods that I'm going to be teaching, four online lectures, are simply, the point is to clear the ground. Is to say, remember what you've been taught, and let's see how this makes sense in the book of Revelation. Because I want to diffuse all the fear up front. That's the goal. So, that's my warning, that's my disclaimer. You are going to be getting basics the first 2 weeks. Okay? Okay. Does that help a little? I'm hoping it does. My idea is to lower your anxiety. All right. Let me first just talk to you about my interaction with the book of Revelation. Gee, many Christmas. This classroom is small. Honestly, growing up, Book of Revelation was never really talked about in the congregations I was in. It was one of those things that maybe there were whisperings about it in the hallways, but nobody ever really wanted to. You didn't have a Bible study on it. Why? Because usually people take one of two positions when it comes to Revelation. They're either completely obsessed with the book, obsessed to the point where every little thing that happens in their lives, everything that they read, no matter where they're at in the Bible, Revelation is the one that's doing it. Even though it was the very last one written, It surely is found in all the rest of them. Or people are just completely ignorant of it. They don't want to touch it. They don't have a clue what to do with it. They're afraid of it. And so they just leave it to the dusty edges of the New Testament. It closes out the canon, but might as well just have been left out. And both extremes are wrong. Both extremes are not helpful. My first interaction with Revelation, I remember it vividly because of how much it frightened me. I'm driving home, like 2:30 in the morning. It's my junior, senior year of high school, from one of my friend's house, late one night, 4061, going from St. Peter's, or from Lake St. Louis to Wentzville, if you're from the area, doesn't matter. Going up 4061, I remember coming up the hill and staring at me square in the face was the moon blood red. And I almost lost control of the car. I was freaking out. I was like, what's going on? You know? I mean, I'm not like a city boy, but I'm more of a suburb boy. And I just never really paid much attention to the moon. But man, whenever you're driving up over the hill and it's staring you in the face, you don't really have a choice. So I come up and I'm like, oh my goodness, I know in the Bible somewhere it says it's blood red, the earth's going to end, everything's done, what's going to happen? So I went home, 2:30 in the morning, I pull open my Bible. And I was like, if it's about the end of the world, it must be in Revelation. So I read Revelation from 2:30 in the morning till 4 in the morning, from front to cover. Chapter 1 all the way through 22. And I remember putting the book down and just being scared spitless. I mean, I was freaking out. I was like, oh my gosh, there's going to be locusts flying everywhere soon. Like, I didn't know what was going on. Didn't have a clue. Later on, I begin to ask the question, is that what the Bible is supposed to do? Is that what God intended with Revelation? To be a cosmic fortune teller where he's got this really intricate code that if you're smart enough, you can break it. And if you do, then you know all of the secrets of the future in the universe. Look into my magic ball. Is that what it is? Is this intention through his communicated word of God, communicated by the Holy Spirit, to his apostle John, for the churches of Asia Minor, in intending to scare the people to the point where what they can do is just shake and say, I guess I'll just follow Jesus. Is that what he was intending to do? Does he play coy with us? In the rest of the Bible, does he like to do stuff like this? Have fun little games? It's hidden in the mysteries of the Bible. Oh, Paul talks about mystery. Yeah, it's called the cross. That's what the reference is in Paul when he's talking about mystery. It is a bit of a mystery, even today, even the people that claim to understand it. I think the cross is still quite mysterious. I began to question whether or not that's how Revelation should be handled, because it's awkward to me. Still didn't really have any answers, though. Till my sophomore year of Bible college, I took the book of Revelation with Jim Johnson, who's one of our trustees now, and I fell in love with the book, because I realized the book can be used for more than just scaring people. It can actually challenge us to stand firm in our faith, even in the face of persecution. It can call us to a level that we've never been called to before. From that, I decided I'm going to go and I'm going to dedicate my life to studying this book. Because I think this is the book the church screws up the most, and I think it's the book the church needs the most. With all that's in me, I believe that. One of the chapters in the book on Dragons, John, and Every Grain of Sand is in defense of eschatology. I'm writing, my whole chapter is me writing on why I think studying Revelation and eschatology in general is so important. And why I think that because a lot of the reasons why the church is so messed up in a lot of different ways in America is because we have bad eschatology. We don't understand Revelation. We'll get to that in a bit. So, dedicating my life, I decided to find out who I could study under that would give me the best opportunity to understand Revelation. Found out Dr. Lowry, who is teaching at Lincoln, was an Aberdeen scholar. Don't find those very often in our movement, by the way. Studied under I. Howard Marshall and did his PhD work on Revelation. So I thought, well, that's awesome. So I went up there, was there for 4 years. Out of my 99 master's hours, I think 60 of them were with Dr. Lowry. Made sure I took everything he was teaching. I took Revelation in some capacity 5 different times because he would always tweak different things for me to do that are different. The point was, he was going to teach me how to do this. From that, I decided, you know what? Writing my master's thesis on this isn't enough. I want to do my PhD work on it. And so now I'm currently doing it at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland on the Book of Revelation. In particular, I'll tell you my question, which should not influence your papers necessarily. But it's how does the Book of Revelation interact with the Roman Empire? That's my question. So I'm looking at the different political imagery of the Roman Empire and how they were communicating their dominance. And I'm asking, how does that imagery surface in the Book of Revelation? And when it does, how does he tell me to respond? That's what I'm doing. So the political politics of John, if you will. And that's what I've been dedicating a lot of my life to, studying this book. If you go on my website, out of all the lectures I have, I have about 80 hours to 100 hours of lecture, either audio or visual, on Revelation. I'm not obsessed with the book. I'm dedicated to it because I believe this is one of the chinks in the armor of the American church. So, that's my story. And now we're here. In M39, Ozark Christian College, studying it together. So where do we begin? Where do we begin when we're studying the Book of Revelation? I function off of three principles. If you're listening to my lectures online, this will sound familiar, because I begin every one of my lectures on Revelation with this. Every church I speak at, every conference I speak at, these three principles I surface right off the bat, because I want to make sure everybody understands where I'm coming from and why I'm coming from there. First, I function off the principle of humility. Dr. Lowry used to always tell us in just hermeneutics classes, he says, humility, in interpretation, humility is king, and context is very important. Humility is king. In other words, I do not stand before you today and claim that I have 100% of my theology accurate. But if I knew what wasn't accurate, I would change it, right? But I'm not going to sit up here and act like I'm infallible. And I'm not going to teach this class like, just because I've studied and read, you know, a couple 100,000 pages on this, that you're an idiot, you can't tell me anything that I don't know. That's just not true. That's the beauty of community. Is that in community, I am expecting to learn from you just as much as you're probably expecting to learn from me. That's the point. Principle of humility. I don't claim to have Revelation totally solved. I don't claim to have all my, you know, T's crossed and my I's dotted. I don't claim to have it all figured out. And that's the way that I function at every Bible book that I come to. So, you're allowed to disagree with me. You hear that? Notice there's no written tests in this class. The only thing that's in this class that'll be test-like are in what chapters, because I want you to know this book inside and out. But I'm not going to put a test in front of you and say, you need to regurgitate what I believe on this book. Because this book has so many different people saying so many different things. And so you're allowed to disagree with me. I'm okay with that. I'll sleep fine at night. It'll be cool. However, when we disagree, there's two things that I put down as absolutes. Number one, you have to disagree with respect. It's just not fair to start lobbing bombs at people in the community of God because you disagree with somebody. That takes me off more than anything on a lot of issues. If I get an email from someone, and I do a lot, nasty emails about Revelation, and it's not signed, I don't read it. I just delete it. There's no point. They're not looking to edify me. They don't want to be on a journey of truth with me. They don't want to try to figure out this story that is really complex with me. They just want to tear me down. I just don't have time for that. Because there's way too many people hurting for us to be hurting each other. So, principle of humility. I'm not going to claim to have it all done. The second thing, though, that I demand whenever you disagree with me is you have to tell me why. You know? Can't just say, well, I disagree. Okay, why? Because if you're right, I want to change. And if you can't tell me why, then maybe you're not right. And maybe you should change. You see what I'm saying? It's like, are we really in this together to try to build each other up? Or you just want to be right? In every conversation that you have in the dorms or in a classroom, that's always something you got to ask yourself. Am I just trying to win? Or am I trying to draw closer to Jesus? I don't care if you win. I don't care if I win. I want to know the truth that shapes my life. I want to know Jesus inside and out. And I believe that you know things about the truth, about Jesus, that I've never heard before. And I want to hear them. Because I want to grow. You hear into this? And this may sound really selfish, and I apologize. But that's the way this has to function. Otherwise, as a community, we can't function. So, cool if you disagree with me, because I'm not claiming to have it all figured out. But we got to do it with respect, and you have to tell me why. Cool? Everybody down with that? That is a rule in this class. One of the only rules I have, but that is a rule. Second principle I function by. It's the principle of submission. I am absolutely committed to letting the Bible tell me what it wants to say instead of forcing the Bible to say what I want it to say. I told you, we're going over basics. I'm very committed to this, though. I frankly don't care what your opinion is on this, this, and this, and this, if the Bible says something different. I'm not interested in coming up with new creative ideas that I can push so that I can sell books. I'm worried about what is the Spirit telling me, and as a result of that, I'm submitting to the Spirit's washing over me with His Word so that I can transform my own life into what He wants it to be. When it comes to Revelation, it's very easy to come to it and make it say what you want it to say and not allow it to speak at all. With the Bible, that's easy in the Bible as a whole. Revelation, that's the playing field. That's the battleground it mostly rests in, is people making it say what they want it to say and not even asking what is it saying. So I'm very committed to the principle of submission, submitting to the washing of the Word over me to transform what I think instead of me telling the Word what it needs to be saying. Third principle, principle of context. And I think I believe it in that order, by the way. I'm not so sure I believe context is king. I do believe it's very important. I agree with Dr. Lowry. Very important. But if you don't have humility and you don't have submission, well, you can even finagle context. Principle of context. Why do I hold it? Well, what's the basic answer of this? Without context, you can say anything you want. You can make the Bible say anything you want. You can make a person say anything you want. Political debates. Most of the time, the bombs that are being lobbed across the different, well, maybe not this State of the Union address, because they may be integrating. Whoa, how nice. If you guys don't know that, anyway, whatever. The bombs that are being lobbed across, though, in a political avenue, a lot of times have to do with context, yes? They'll say, well, this person said this, or they voted for this, and the person comes back and says, but you don't know the context in which I said that. Or, no, actually in that bill, there was a broader things that were being voted on. So yes, whenever I voted yes for this, I had to vote no for this, but if I had to vote that by itself, I wouldn't have voted no, I would have voted yes. They're arguing context, constantly. Chris DeWelt once told me, and I actually have it written on my board, or on my window in my office, all that we have is our context. Context. Context is what we're constantly wrestling with. When it comes to the Bible, same things apply. So, we're going to do some basic things that you've heard before, hopefully in principles. If not, well, welcome to interpretation class. That hopefully you have heard before that will not be new to you, but we're going to go over them again anyway. Context. Okay, I can take four passages. You've heard this before, but this is the context in which we are speaking this. Four passages, string them together and make them tell you to do something very disturbing. Matthew chapter 27, verse 5, Luke chapter 9, verse 60, Luke chapter 3, verse 11, and John chapter 13, verse 27. String them together and what do I get? Judas went out and hanged himself. Finish it. Anybody know this one? Judas went out and hanged himself. Go thou and do likewise, and what you do, do quickly. Well, it's all from the Bible. Right? I told you what passages they are. Maybe it'll help if I write them up there. Maybe that'll help. These are all in the Bible. I'm not making this up. It's Matthew chapter 27, verse 5b. What is it? Luke 3:11. Is that what I said? No? Yeah, 960. You're right. 960. Luke 3:11 and John 13:27b. If I string them together, I can make them say whatever I want. Judas went out and hanged himself. Go thou and do likewise, and what you do, do quickly. Now, is that what the Bible's telling us to do? Please tell me you have an answer to that question. Okay, otherwise, otherwise your altar call is not going well, because I don't see you guys running out grabbing ropes. No. Right? Why? I'm shattering the context of each of these, aren't I? I can make the Bible say whatever I want. All I need to do is to ignore context. I can make it say whatever I want. Like Matthew chapter 18, verse 20. Turn there with me, friends. Matthew chapter 18, verse 20. Some of you will have this memorized. You may not know that this is where the verse is found, but you will have this memorized because you hear it a lot. Chapter 18, verse 20. For where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. Well, sometimes it says also. There am I with them. Who's speaking there? Yeah, it's red letters. Hello. Jesus. Jesus is speaking. Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am them with them also. I'm there with them. We're right there. Which a lot of times the context I hear this in is this. You'll come to a service, a prayer service, or maybe a Bible study one night, small church. And oh man, you're waiting, 10 minutes goes by, you know, everything was supposed to already be started, and huh. Well, that's strange. Only two of us, three of us have showed up. So you're like, well, should we do the Bible study, or should we do the prayer thing, or should we just go home? And then the holy one in the group steps up and he says, well, you do remember where two or three are gathered in Jesus' name, there he is with them also, right? Oh, you're right, we should still pray. You know, usually this verse is used to justify poor attendance at our programs in our churches. That's what it's used for, right? And it usually never comes up in any other context. That's the only one we know how to use it in. Oh, there's only a couple people here. Well, it doesn't mean Jesus isn't. As if his omnipresence only kicks into action whenever two or three people show up. I had my friend make this. It says, oh, little girl's sitting there. I wish somebody else would come so Jesus could come in. Because she's got to wait for two to three. And there's only one. Is that how the verse is supposed to be used? We just rip it out of context and make it say whatever we want. What is the real context of this passage? Yeah. Church discipline. No wonder we're ignorant of it. Because we don't do that in our churches. Lawsuits come our way if you church discipline somebody. And you know what? What's really convenient is if you church discipline them here, those go down the street. Because we don't even call other churches to make sure that somebody hasn't been church disciplined for a real reason. And we're not inviting a wolf in. Hey, our attendance is higher. That's all that matters. Notice, even if you hear cynicism in my voice about the church, you'll realize the church means a lot to me. So don't think I'm bashing on the church. But I am pointing out some of the weaknesses that we commonly function under. Let's look at the context. Verse 15 of chapter 18. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother over. Job all done. But if he will not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Where does that line come from? Testimony may be established by two or three witnesses. You can give me the general answer, not the specific. Yeah. The Old Testament, Deuteronomy. Yeah. Two or three witnesses. Why? That's Jewish law. In order for a testimony, an accusation, somebody against somebody in the community of the Jews to be valid, two to three witnesses had to verify it. Which is the reason why when Jesus is on trial, they had to fabricate two to three witnesses. They were trying to follow the law in order to convict somebody they knew was innocent. Ironic. But it depends on which laws you emphasize. Verse 17, if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. Which I've had to do that, by the way. And that's brutal. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Had to do that too a couple times. And it's brutal. I tell you the truth, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. That's authority language there. Again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. Now, is that about attendance? No. It has nothing to do with attendance. It's all about discipline. But if you take the Bible out of context, you can make it say whatever you want. If you don't want to deal with the whole church discipline thing, shoot, then just make it an attendance passage. convenient. But it really becomes quite dangerous. Let's move on to the next one. Philippians, where am I going? 4:13. Exactly. I would say just quote it for me, and yet I want us all to actually look at the context. So turn there. Philippians chapter 4, verse 13. I can do all everything through Him who gives me strength. I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. Mark Moore told me this story once. And I'm sure you've heard it before. He uses it more than once. But the way he told me was a little bit different, because he threw a little jab in there at me, but we'll get to that in a minute. He said he was at a CIY conference. This probably was like 10 years ago now. He's at a CIY conference, and Mark's a pretty buff guy. He may mask it with his clothing, but he's a buff guy. He's very in shape. Matter of fact, at one point I was talking to him, he was doing P90X with his wife in the morning and with the group in the afternoon, and he was still working out on his own normal schedule. He was just doing those just for community purposes. I'm like, dude, I can barely walk. I did P90X. You know. Anyway, very in shape guy. So whenever he travels, he works out. He tries to work out somewhere. And he was in Colorado, and he goes to the workout place. And he said whenever he walked in, he was getting ready to do his weightlifting, and he noticed these two, well, the way he said it was, two scrawny guys that kind of looked like you. That's what he was, and I was like, what's this supposed to mean? And, you know, he just keeps going, you know, his bald head shining as gloriously as ever. And he says he sees two guys come in. He said, you know, he's like, the one of them maybe weighed 120, the other one like 105. I mean, really small guys. He said he looks at them, and he notices they're at the bench press, which is, you know, like a bench that lays down. You lay underneath it, you grab the bar and push it up and down. That's what it is. Some people have no idea what it is. I got to make sure I'm being very clear. Basics, people, basics. So he's sitting there, and all of a sudden he notices that they put on like 215 pounds. So he's like, yeah, I'm going to wait because I may need to like rush someone to the hospital in a minute. So he says that the littlest one, the buck 05 guy, lays down. He said, and his friend helps him push the bar up. He said, as soon as his friend's hands leave the bar, it crashes on his chest. And his friend's struggling and doing whatever he can to push up, grunting. And his friend behind him, why guys do this, I have no idea. But behind him, his friend's yelling at him, come on, Johnny! You know, like that's going to help. Usually when somebody's yelling at me in the weight room, I'm like, will you shut up? I'm trying to lift. You know, like, you just, come on. Anyway, he's screaming at me. He's like, come on, Johnny, you can do it. And then he said, you can do all things through Christ who gives you strength. Here's the problem. If Johnny can't lift the bar, there's one of four things happening there. Number one, maybe Johnny's faith's just not big enough. Have you heard that before? Shane, you want to know why that your mom has breast cancer and it's not being healed? She doesn't have enough faith. So I was told as a sophomore in high school. Or maybe Jesus doesn't really have the power to help him. He gives him the promise, but Jesus really can't deliver because he's really not that good. Or a third option, maybe Jesus does have the power, but he doesn't care to help him because he's really just that evil. Or maybe that passage has nothing to do with Johnny on a bench press anyway. My point is this, pulling things out of context can be fun to make a point, but it can do a lot of damage to a lot of people's faiths. It's not just fun and games. We're not just figuring out who can put together the coolest puzzle when it comes to Revelation. We're trying to make sure that we're having correct doctrine so that people's lives aren't destroyed whenever they don't have enough faith to lift a bar. See what I'm saying? I had my friend draw this. Holding this friend. Go ahead and jump. You can do all things through Christ who gives you strength as he stares over a cliff. Is that what the passage is for? And you know, and all we have to do is read three verses earlier. Verse 10, I. Who is the I here in Philippians chapter 4? Paul. I, Paul, rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. See, what's happening is the Philippian church had not been able to support him monetarily. But now they are able to. And he's saying, thanks, but don't think that I'm totally relying on you. Because I've learned to be content no matter what the circumstances have been. And then he goes on to explain that. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything who gives me strength. What is the context of the passage? Yeah, really, riches and poverty. He's saying it doesn't matter if I've been going well fed, or if I've had plenty, or if I've had nothing and not eaten at all. I've still been able to spread the gospel. I'm thankful that you guys are supporting me now. That's awesome. But don't think that I've been waiting on you in order to make my mission complete. Because it is Jesus that I rely on. In Him, I can do what He has called me to do no matter what obstacles are in front of me. To spread the gospel. See what's happening? It's not about jumping off a cliff. It's about being content no matter what you have so that in any situation you can spread the gospel. But if you take the Bible out of context, you can make it say whatever you want. Judas went out and hanged himself. See what I'm saying? All right. Do I have time to do another example? Let's see, 25 minutes. Oh, 25 minutes. Let me do this. Here's what I really want you to hear. The danger of coming to Revelation and ignoring the context is you can make it say whatever you want. And when you don't have context in place, then you even have the wrong questions. Here's the thing. When it comes to Revelation, you can be asking all these different questions like, when is the end of the world going to come? Or how is the rapture going to occur? Or you can ask all these different questions, and guess what? You'll find answers. But my question is, are you asking the right questions? Isn't that a fair question to ask? Bottom line is, no matter what question I have, I can find an answer in the Bible, especially if I ignore context. But shouldn't the context be the one that's dictating what questions that are even being talked about? I think if we're being honest, it should. Revelation should tell me what questions need to be asked. Not me going to Revelation with a preset of questions that I think it should answer for me. You, Revelation, must answer this question. And John's going, but what if I'm not talking about that? Does it matter? Does it matter, John? Tell me anyway. Okay, so 666 means it's a computer chip. And John's going, a computer what? I don't understand what you mean. One of the questions I'm going to hammer on, especially today and tomorrow, is make sure the questions that you're asking are the same ones that the churches of Asia Minor were questioning themselves. The book was written to seven churches in Asia Minor. We'll get to that tomorrow, or Friday. Matter of fact, chapters 2 and 3, it's pretty much the most heavily red-lettered section in all of Revelation. It's split up into seven sections for seven churches. And we'll actually look at a map where all seven, I've actually walked in all seven of them. They're real cities. They're not pretend. And can I just put this little bit of a reality check in here, showing my cards just a wee bit? Two summers ago, I read all 13 books of the Left Behind series. Because that's what the people in my pews are reading. And I say 13 because I don't count the prequels, because if you're a good enough writer, you should be able to put that information in the real books. Anyway. That's totally a literary critique, which I've got an 80-page critique going right now on the Left Behind series, and I've only made it through the literary section. So, but let me say this. This is what bothered me. A lot. A lot. 13 books, not one time was one of the cities of Asia Minor ever mentioned by name. Not once. Well, that's kind of strange. Matter of fact, Hank Hinegraaff and a guy named Sigmund Brouwer also came out with kind of a response fictitious series called The Last Disciple to Left Behind series, but it's written from more of a preterist view. Not once in the two books that are out has any of the seven churches of Revelation been mentioned by name. I have a problem with that. Why? Because the book starts off saying this is written to seven churches in Asia Minor that are going through real things at a real time. They're real people. And to sit there and say that the entire book has nothing to do with them, it only has to do with events happening 2,000 years later. If I got that book in Ephesus or in Pergamum and my friend Antipas had just been killed, I'd say, thanks, John, but no thanks, because this means nothing to me. What does it mean to me that you're talking about events that I never will experience? How does that help me cope with the Roman Empire staring me at the face right now, John? It's easy to read Revelation and ignore the first three chapters, but if you do that, you can make the book say whatever you want. There are not 19 chapters in Revelation, there are 22, and the first three tell me the questions I need to be asking. But if I take it out of context, I make the book say whatever I want. For example, one of the assumptions that is commonly brought to Revelation is that what the book of Revelation is defining is a chronological roadmap of the future. Chronological roadmap of the future. What do I mean by that? Define this for me. Yeah, basically, oh, I forgot my book. I have Tim LaHaye and Thomas Ice's book where you have a foldout in the front of the book of an actual map of how the days are going to end. It's a timeline. A lot of times people come and they say Revelation is a timeline of the end days. This is how it's going to happen. Which, what does the word last days even mean in the Bible? But that's something you'll read about. I don't know if I have a chance to talk about it. Maybe I have you listen to one of the video lectures. I make you listen to that?
All the different texts.
Good. Because I go through every single one of the last days texts in the New Testament. Ask the question, let's let the New Testament define what the words last days means instead of us telling us what it means. Anyway, chronological roadmap of the future. That's one of the assumptions that comes. Let's look at Revelation chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 12. Let me build the context. Hey. Chapter 1. Jesus appears to John on the island of Patmos, who was put there because of the testimony of Jesus Christ. He is put there. Jesus comes, majestic picture that we'll talk about 4 weeks. Where Jesus comes and he's got hair white like wool. He's got, you know, his voice like the rushing waters. He's standing among seven golden lampstands. And he speaks to John. He says, write down what I'm about to tell you because I have a message to the seven churches of Asia Minor. Chapters 2 and 3 are those messages. The seven churches from Ephesus to Laodicea. Chapter 4 comes along and John is brought up into the heavenly realm. He's in the throne room of God. And he sees this majestic scene where there are four living creatures that are crying out, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come, around the throne day and night without ceasing. 24 elders who sit on thrones, they get off their thrones, put down their crowns, and cry out another song of majesty. Chapter 5 comes, John asks the question, who is worthy to open up the scroll that is sitting in the right hand of the one sitting on the throne? John's weeping, elder comes along and says, chill out, John, there is someone that's worthy, it's the lamb. Or he says, it's the lion of Judah. He turns and looks, and it's a slain lamb. Slain lamb is there. The slain lamb then is praised and worshipped in the same ways that the one on the throne was worshipped, which that's interesting for some parallels we'll talk about later. And then chapter 6 comes, where first you have the four horsemen and the four seals that are broken. The fifth one is broken. You have martyrs underneath the throne crying out, how long, O Lord, till you avenge our blood? A question that some of the churches in Asia Minor probably were asking. How long until you avenge our blood? And then comes verse 12. So that's the context. You're thinking, I don't remember any of that. You will. You'll get it. This is all going to be natural to you by the end. Okay? Remember, broad strokes right now. Broad strokes. Verse 12. Who is the I there? John. He's the one that is watching. He's the one giving us the message. I watched as he, who is he? Yes, the slain lamb, Jesus. I, John, watched as he, the slain lamb, opened the sixth seal. So we're at number 6. There are 7. The 7th one isn't broken until chapter 8. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red. Oh my word. Remember that? Oh baby. Here we go! And the stars in the sky fell to the earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. Here's my question. Put on your science hats. Okay. If one star falls to the earth, what happens to us? Why do you say, I mean, the sound effects is all I receive, but why do you say that? Yeah, the diameter of any, the smallest star is like 10 times bigger than the whole diameter of the Earth. Plus, it's a big ball of fire and gas, right? Yeah? So one star falls. The Earth is done. Yes? And it uses the word stars more than one falls to the Earth. So here's my question. Where are we at? On the chronological timeline, where are we at? The end of everything. It's over, baby. Time's up. Earth's being destroyed. It's over. Here's the problem. We have 16 more chapters in the book of Revelation. If we're moving on a chronological roadmap, everything that happens after chapter 6, verses 12 through 14, has to happen after the whole earth is destroyed. Well, that's awkward, to say the least. Oh, let's just keep reading, though, on that same section, because it's not like we're just going to lay our lives down on stars falling. No, no, we're better than that. Verse 14, the sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. This whole global warming debate, I don't really care what side that you're on, but notice something that's interesting about it. They are worried about the level of the ocean raising a couple of inches of water. Because if it does that, all of a sudden, it doesn't just put whole masses of water or masses of land underwater, but it also would change the entire climate of the earth. Now, here's my question. If we decided to remove every mountain and island on the earth, what would happen? Science fans. Well, we can say this. It's over. The life's not going to be inhabitable. It's going to freak everything out. Because whole islands being disappeared, that's going to cause some major problems. Whole mountains being wiped away, what would that do with just the wind in and of itself? The climate patterns would change, possibly making the whole world back in the ice age again, if you believe in that thing. My point is this. Once again, it kind of sounds like he's saying everything's done. Not stars aren't just falling. All the islands are gone. All the mountains are gone. Everything is over. Everything's being made new. But once again, we're only in chapter 6. Oh, let's keep reading. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, every slave and every free man, hid in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of the wrath has come, and who can stand? What does that sound like? Theologians, think here. What does that sound like? Judgment day. Yeah? The great day of the wrath of the Lamb has come, and who can stand? Did you notice what I was doing up here whenever I was listing off all the people? How many are there? Ooh. Numbers may be important in apocalyptic literature, by the way. It's possible, especially to a Jew. Seven is a number for completion. And he lists seven people that would fall in the category of evil, where complete evil is now facing the great day of the wrath. What does that sound like? Judgment day. So with stars falling, islands and mountains moving, and the great judgment day language being used, it sounds like everything is over. That presents a major problem if I'm developing a timeline of chronology. Because then everything after chapter 6, verse 17, would have to happen after everything was over. Oh, but that's not the only time that happens in Revelation. No, no, my friends. This happens quite often. Turn to Revelation chapter 11. Verse 15 through 18. Notice we're in the seventh trumpet now. For the seventh seal, or the sixth seal, took us to the end. And now the seventh trumpet's going to do the same thing. Chapter 11, verses 15 through, 18. The seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there was a loud voice in heaven, in which said, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever." Ooh, what does that sound like? Sounds like end of everything stuff. And the 24 elders who were seated on the thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, "We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was." What is missing?
Is to come.
The first time this is said is in Revelation chapter 4, verse 9. This is the second time it is said, but the tripartite, the one who is and who was and who is to come, is broken. Now there's only two. The one that is to come is no longer is to come. What is he? He's there. Why? Because is to come usually points to, in Jewish minds, to judgment. But now, in Revelation chapter 11, verses 15 through 18, we're at judgment day. Which is indicated by that, but then it's built upon as we keep going. Because you have taken your great power and have begun to reign. Verse 18. The nations were angry and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead. In case you've missed it, let me be as clear as I can be. The time has come for judging the dead and for rewarding your servants, the prophets and your saints and those who reverence your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. Where are we? Judgment Day. Problem is, we still have 11 more chapters in the book of Revelation. Let's look at Revelation chapter 16, verses 17 through 21. You will notice some of the language is similar to what we've already seen. This is the seventh seal, or the seventh bowl that is poured out. Verse 17 begins, and it reads as follows. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, "It is done!" Oh, I wish John would have put tetelestai there, but he didn't. It is done. Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. No earthquake like it has ever occurred since man has been on the earth. So tremendous was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Every island fled away, and the mountains could not be found. What does that sound like? We've heard this before. Chapter 6. Which, where was chapter 6? The end of everything. Once again, the seals, trumpets, and bowls all take us at least at some point to the end of everything. All of them. And that's not the only time. You also have in Revelation chapter 19, 11 through 21, with the coming of the great white warrior who is coming and he judges everybody. And then you have Revelation chapter 20, 11 through 15, the great white judgment of the throne. Every time that we come to the book of Revelation, or every time we come to the end of the world, it is signifying something quite significant in the book of Revelation. And the thing is we come to the end of the world multiple times in the book. So if I'm suggesting that the book needs to tell me what the chronological roadmap is, I have major problems, because that's not a question that Revelation is addressing. Matter of fact, Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, right smack dab in the middle of the book, guess what? It's a nativity scene. It's Jesus being born. Let me prove it. Verse 12, or chapter 12, verses 1 and following. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. Numbers. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Okay, pregnant woman. Okay? Who is she pregnant with? Jump down to verse 5. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. Who is that? In the Jewish mind, they would initially say Messiah. It comes from the Psalms. For the Messiah will be the one that rules all the nations with an iron scepter. Yes? From a Christian perspective, we define that as Jesus. So, the woman is pregnant, verses 1 through 2, with Jesus, verse 5. And in the middle, verse 3 and 4, then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. Because of this passage, in honor of my mentor, Dr. Lowry, every Christmas, our nativity scene, we have a red dragon that sits in the back, behind the animals, behind the magi, behind the shepherds, because ours isn't historically accurate, behind Mary and Joseph and the baby. There's a dragon. Why? Because that's what John is describing here. The birth of the one who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. See, what John's saying is this. Even though the world looks like this, there's much more beyond what the eye can see that's actually happening. The world will try to convince you that only what you can see and touch and taste, that's all that exists. But John says, you know what? In the peaceful town of Bethlehem, there is a dragon that is lurking trying to devour the Christ child. There is a cosmic war that is raging. Here is my point. If Revelation is a chronological roadmap of the future, then everything after chapter 12 would have to happen after the birth of Jesus, and everything before chapter 12 would have to have happened before. Awkward. Yes? Because chapter 6 sounded like it was the end of the world. But did that happen before Jesus? Or my point is this. You have to keep it in context. Don't come to Revelation with a preset list of questions that it must answer. Otherwise, you will not listen. Allow Revelation to answer the questions it wants to answer. Because it does want to answer some. It does have an agenda. It does have a point to impact your life in the same way that it impacted the lives of the churches of Asia Minor. But to come to Revelation and say, you must tell me when the world ends. To come to Revelation and say that you must follow the guidelines of the chronological roadmap of the future. That you must tell me when the tribulation's coming. That you must tell me when the rapture's coming. Is to simply be asking questions Revelation is not intent on answering. How do I know? Because whenever I try to find the answers, I have to twist it and turn it and pull it and push it. Especially on this issue. Because my word, how many times can I come to the end of the world before I realize that maybe it's not trying to just list out all the events that are to come? Or what do I do? Honestly, can I tell you what they do with chapter 12, the people that are trying to force this into a chronological roadmap? Nothing. They don't know what to do with it. They pretty much just kind of skim over and ignore it. Because there's not much you can do with it when it's the birth of Jesus. Sorry, we don't know anybody else that's a male child that'll rule the nations with an iron scepter. That imagery is very Jewish, very clear. It's Messiah language. And so they don't know what to do with it, so they just ignore it. Why? Because if that is Jesus, that destroys the whole timeline. Because by chapter 12, we're supposed to be right in the middle of the tribulation by then. And if Jesus is just being born, well. And I'm not going to suggest he's being born a second time, because that's just crazy. Well, it gets even crazier than that. Okay. One more thing. We have 6 minutes, 5 minutes, a little. Why is Revelation study important? I'm going to give you one example, and it comes out of here. Well, there's only four of you all over here. The Revelation is important is because it will affect the way you read the rest of the Bible. And no, I'm not over-exaggerating that. It will affect the way you read the rest of the Bible. There are five other reasons why, but we'd only have time to go through one. Okay? It will affect the way you read the rest of the Bible. I have given you a copy of a section, where's my book? Out of this, the old Scofield Reference Bible. This is the reprinted edition of the 1917 edition. One of the very first ones ever to roll off the press. Scofield would be one of the ones that looks at Revelation as a chronological roadmap. That is who he is. And this was one of the very first study Bibles ever in existence. So if you have an NIV study Bible, Scofield's the one that kind of led that caravan, which is a great accomplishment. Because, man, study Bibles are very helpful. They can be. As long as people understand that what's below the text is not infallible. because it's not. I want to start reading at the very bottom of the left side of the page, where there's a little 2. And it starts with the words, having announced the kingdom of heaven. Everybody know where I'm at? Right down here? Having announced the kingdom of heaven? 2 lines from the bottom. Where are we in the book of Matthew? Sermon on the Mount. What's in the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, my word. It's like, it's the Sermon on the Mount. It's the Christian manifesto. I mean, it is how we live, right? Well, let's listen to how Scofield describes it. Having announced the kingdom of heaven as at hand, the king in Matthew 5 through 7 declares the principles of the kingdom. I have no problem with that so far. The Sermon of the Mount has a twofold application. Number one, literally to the kingdom. How do you define the word literally? Anyway, literally to the kingdom. In this sense, it gives the divine constitution for the righteous government of the earth. So he says, in its sense, in the primary application, it gives the divine constitution, the way in which the government of the earth will function, the righteous government will function in the kingdom. Okay? So I'm going to be exegeting this as we go. Whenever the kingdom of God is established on earth, what is that right there? What do we notice? The very first word gives me a big tip about what he thinks. Whenever means the kingdom has not been established yet from Scofield's perspective. Okay? Whenever the kingdom of heaven is established on earth, It will be according to that constitution, to the Sermon on the Mount, which may be regarded as an explanation of the word righteousness as used by the prophets in describing the kingdom, Isaiah 11:4, etc. In this sense, the Sermon on the Mount is pure law and transfers the offense from the overt action to the motive. And he gives some examples. Now skip down to the bottom of that paragraph, four lines up from the bottom of that paragraph. And it begins with the word for these reasons. Following me? Four lines up from that paragraph, toward like about a quarter of the way into that sentence, or into that line. For these reasons, the Sermon on the Mount, in its primary application, listen to this, gives neither the privilege nor the duty of the church. Oh, let that sink in. In its primary application, the Sermon on the Mount has nothing to say to the church. Not the privilege or their duty. It has nothing to do with them. And then he goes on. These, the privilege and duty of the church, are found in the epistles. And then he presents what he perceives as a contradiction between the Sermon on the Mount and the epistles. He says, under the law of the kingdom, for example, no one may hope for forgiveness who is not first forgiven, Matthew 6, etc. Under grace, the epistles, the Christian is exhorted to forgive because he is already forgiven. What he's saying is this, Sermon on the Mount has nothing to do with the church. Why? Because of this. He believes that the kingdom is at the end of the chronological timeline for the roadmap, because that's how he reads Revelation. He believes that Jesus came intending to establish the kingdom, but in chapter 12, the controversy of Beelzebub with Jesus in Matthew chapter 12, whenever they say, you're empowered by Beelzebub, he says, that's the point when Jesus says, fine, I'm not going to establish the kingdom, I'll go to plan B, the stinking church. But that means everything before Matthew 12 has to do with the kingdom, not the church. Therefore, the Sermon on the Mount has nothing to say to you as the church because you're not the kingdom. I don't know about you. I have a problem with that. Because I believe in Matthew chapter 4, verse 13, when Jesus says, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is that near, that he wasn't mistaken. That the church does have something to do with the kingdom. That he is standing and sitting at the right hand of God, reigning. Matter of fact, in Revelation chapter 1, John even says, we are kingdom and priests. Oh, John, you silly goof. Haven't you read Scofield? No, we're not. On that note, love you guys. See you on Friday.